Hello, everyone. This is Patricia, your Chinese auntie. I have a request. If you like the podcast, please take 30 seconds to like the show, review it, and share your favorite episodes with your friends. Tell your friends. I appreciate you so much.
Welcome to Conversations with Your Chinese Auntie podcast.
And so the thing is, they're throwing them to the crowd. So you have to be interactive, because if not, you would get slapped in the face with a moon pie or some bees, because you're looking over here and stuff is coming. It is. And so my lady's with me, so she done got in the head with some bees, and I came in and I caught some bees right before it hit her. And I was excited. Just because it was black owned in the black community, we're gonna make a difference, we're gonna make a change. Yeah, there was dope on campus, there was dope deals going down, transactions.
I am so excited for you to meet Henry M. Pittman. Henry is a licensed therapist and counselor. He assisted in my somatic experiencing SE 3-year training. The training was all done online except for the last level. So we met in person last year in Atlanta. Henry is passionate about his work. He is wise, knowledgeable, and a great storyteller. And he's so funny. In this episode, we talk about a lot of things. He explains how to do Mardi Gras properly. Basically, you need to bring a bag and pay attention. If not, you will get hit by the things they throw from the floats. He shares his journey and how he realized when he was in an abusive relationship. He also gives excellent advice for new therapists. Here is my conversation with Henry. Listen to the end as he does this jazzy trombone thing. I think it's called scat. It's awesome. Hello, Henry.
What's up, Patricia?
What's up? I missed you. How are you?
I am well. I've been on the go ever since, what's that, February 4th? So traveling from Houston, Texas to Orlando, Florida to Orlando, Florida to Miami, Florida, to be on a cruise with me and my lady for 4 days in the Bahamas, and then to spend a day and a half, so to speak, in Mobile, Alabama on the way back, which is my hometown for Mardi Gras. Because it wasn't the plan to stop in Mobile for Mardi Gras. I didn't realize when we was coming back, so I looked at the schedule, wait a minute, I think Mardi Gras is going on this weekend. Sure enough, it did. So, saw family, did the parade. She was excited because that was her first Mardi Gras. She's from Dayton, Ohio, so she's never been to Mardi Gras. And me educating her on how to do Mobile Mardi Gras. She's like, I've been to parades. I'm like, sweetie, you need a bag. You need to put stuff in. She said, what you mean? I said, it's very interactive.
Please tell us how to do it. I know nothing about it.
Okay. I'm gonna begin with just Mobile, Alabama itself, because Mobile started Mardi Gras in the 1800s, and many times it throws people off to hear Mobile, Alabama as the originators of Mardi Gras, because people know about New Orleans, or how some people now say New Orleans. So in New Orleans, Louisiana, it's a tourist city. So it's very popular, but because it's popular doesn't mean that it's the originator. Mobile is the originator. It's next door neighbor, well, a couple states over. And so in Mobile, and we said doing how to do Mardi Gras is that you come with a bag, because it's not just a parade of floats and dancers and high school bands and performances. Is that on the floats, they're throwing items out to the crowd. they're throwing candy, bubble gum, of course, bees. People know a lot about the bees, but it's more than just bees. Bees, moon pie, chocolate cakes, stuffed animals, hula hoops, ramen noodles.
Okay, no, wait. Let's just go back to chocolate cake. What do you mean they're throwing chocolate cake? Like in a container, like a piece?
No, they're a package. They come in a box.
Oh.
And so it's just miniature cakes that they are throwing out. Or sometimes they would throw a whole bag. And so the thing is, they're throwing them to the crowd. So you have to be interactive, because if not, you would get slapped in the face with a moon pie or some bees, because you're looking over here and stuff is coming. It is. And so my lady's with me, so she done got hit in the head with some bees, and I've came in and I caught some bees right before it hit her, and then I put them on myself. It is such a blast. It is such a blast. So it's not that you're just sitting there looking at the floats and just waving how you would see a routine parade and, oh, that's nice. No. You see the bands, but the bands in the South, they dance. So they're dancing and planning and grooving, and another float comes and you hear people saying, moon pies, or throw me beaver, hula hoop, hula hoop. It's a Mardi Gras hula hoop that they have, and stuffed animals. How many stuffed animals I get? I got three. Did I get three?
Wow.
We got a ton of stuff just for one day. We went for that morning and then that evening. And each parade is different. Each parade has a different theme to it. They're not the same.
Okay, when you say each parade, how many parades are there in a day?
That day was five, six, seven. Seven parades. There's a schedule that tells you from 12 o'clock to that evening. They tell you where the parades are going to be at. Most of the parades are downtown Mobile. Most of them. There's a few that are in different locations that have their own map and they have their own route. And so what we used to do growing up, we will start at the 12 o'clock, go to those parades, get in the car, drive over to the next parade when that starts at 3 o'clock, then drive back to downtown for the 5:45 Dragon Parade, which was Saturday. It was the Mystics of Time. They had the Dragon Parade. They got three long floats that are dragons, and people are on top throwing stuff from them. And so it's just a full day, and you don't have to go to all of them. Of course, you don't have to, but nonetheless, it's just a hell of a day. Going from here, then to here, then to here. And of course, the food, you know, it's carnival-like food that's there. Chicken on the stick. Nice fried chicken on the stick. Of course, sausage on the stick. A funnel cake. Ain't nothing like a funnel cake. A true funnel cake. And I'm not talking about one of those pre-made butch. Hold on. Can we use profanity? I'm sorry.
Well, I prefer you don't. Because then if I have to change it to explicit.
Right, so she gets some unfavorable on a cake.
Okay, I don't know what a fauna cake is. Explain. I'm going to have to Google it after this, though. But
and you're going to have to come on down here to the stage.
Yes, I'm going to have to come and visit you.
Yeah. Hospitality, it is welcome. So a fauna cake is pretty much a pancake-like batter that is made in oil. Well, it's fried. And so they take the batter and they actually will loop it and make these designs with it. Nothing, no particular order. They become all crisscross. So you have a cake that is crispy on the outside because it's fried. But then when you crunch into it, bite into it, it's also soft. Mm-hmm. And it has powdered sugar on top, and you can have other toppings such as strawberry, peaches, on top as well. Some places, they have them pre-made. So they're not fresh. They'll take them like an egg or waffle, these funnel cakes, and put them into an oven dispenser, and then it comes out warm.
No, that's a travesty. Don't do that with cakes. Don't do that.
Just fresh.
Fresh. please tell us a bit about yourself?
I am from Mobile, Alabama, Southern State. And I'm the only child of Henry Pittman Jr., excuse me, which was my dad. And some people think that I'm a junior because I'm named after my dad, but I'm Henry M. Pittman. My father's Henry Pittman Jr. because my granddad is Henry Pittman Sr. And my mom did not want me to be a third. So she told my dad, give that boy a middle name. So M, which is Martez. So Henry Martez Pittman. And my mother is Evelyn Joyce Jenkins, her maiden name. So it's the Jenkins and the Pittmans. And both of their origins is in Mississippi, actually. I said, born in Mobile, Alabama, Pritchard area. And parents were married in 71. I was born in 76. And I said, the only child between them. That my father has five sisters. So six of them, he has five sisters. And then my mom has three other siblings. There's four total. And each one is very distinct. So when I talk about my mama and papa, that's my father's side of the family. That's the Pittmans.
Mm-hmm.
When you hear me talk about grandmother, granddad, that's the Jenkins side of the family. Now, a difference in that is that the Jenkins side of the family are educated. Their school was very important. That was the key. My grandfather worked on the railroad. He was also in the Navy. Both of my grandfathers was. He was in the Navy, worked on the railroad. My grandmother could have been a teacher. She could have worked. She chose not to. And they had kids later in life than earlier, around 40s. And so granddad made sure that all his kids, his son and three girls, and my mother being the youngest, was educated. Even despite what the church said per se, which was originally they were Baptists and then they transitioned to becoming Jehovah's Witnesses. And in the Jehovah's Witness faith, the focus is on ministry, ministering God's word, Jesus' love, and so forth. And so education wasn't a primary. My grandfather begged the difference. He said, you can love the Lord and get an education. So my uncle is a educator, master's degree. My Aunt Fanny, educator, master's degree. My Dot, bachelor's, clothing designer. And my mother, bachelor's, two bachelor's, bachelor's in biology and bachelor's of nursing, because she's a nurse, registered nurse, and LVN. And so, and all of them are still alive. Mom just celebrated 50 years of nursing last year, we did.
Wow.
And yes. So a sense of that, I was supposed to be, quote unquote, the doctor coming into the family.
No pressure.
And, right. Doctor mental health. And my mom really wanted to be a nurse practitioner. She said, yet the parents' marriage did not allow that to happen as she wanted it to happen. So my parents, so that's the Jenkins, Snapshot Jenkins. Mama, Papa, Pittman's. Education, not so, because on the Pittman side, I'm the first of a lot. So as far as first one, college. So I'm first generation college from the Pittman side. Although completed high school, also first Pittman, no kids in high school. That's also the first, because that's a theme that the Pittmans have as far as bearing children younger. That my father was a chemical engineer. He did some college in Mobile, that he ended up going to the Air Force. He chose to go to the Air Force because it was during the Vietnam War. So he chose to go military in the Air Force because if he says if he's fighting, he's going to be dropping bombs on people. He ain't finna be a sucker and go hand-to-hand combat. So he went to the Air Force. He was a firefighter. He was stationed in Vietnam and came back. And so he worked here in Houston in Texas City. It was a chemical plant called Amoco. And that's what my dad was there most of his time. His position, chemical engineer operator. As the years gone by and dad got older, the company left. Prior to that, my mother kept encouraging my dad, go to school, Henry, go to school, go to school. Because what ended up happening that as he got older and different jobs, why he had the knowledge of it, he didn't have the paper of it.
Oh.
And those were setbacks for him later on in life. And some of that he bucked it and refused to do. Didn't want to do that. Ain't no need for me to go to school. The fact is that I know all that anyway. True, Dad, but you need the paper to show them that you... And so this is love-hate relationship with education. So while my father's very proud of me, of all it is that I have accomplished and so forth and done, during the process, it wasn't so much. It was, okay, nice son. Oh, you're going to school for this. Nice son. But then later on as an adult, my father said, I am just so proud of you. You've done way more than any Pittman has done. You know, you surpassed me. And he said, I surpassed my dad. He said, that's the way it is supposed to be. And one that does the next. And so that was very heartfelt to hear from my dad. But that's just giving you the dynamics of the Jenkins and the Pittmans. So education is very set in my DNA.
Is it common to be an only child when you were growing up?
It was not uncommon. I'm sitting here because I want to answer that accurately. Wasn't uncommon because it just is. So an only child, it just is. I'm the only child. And I never had a problem being the only child. I never yearned for a sibling. That never was the case with me. I can entertain myself. I don't know if that's because the Gemini in me and this twin. So I was always creative in the stuff, and I'm a social butterfly. And I have friends. And so that was an issue that I agree. It is uncommon to have just one child because routinely you do have multiple children. Like I said, my mom, there's four of them. Mm-hmm. And my grandmother, there's 12 of them. And so, yeah, so like I said, say the grandparents is five. And I don't know. I do not know my Pittman's history. They have not kept records like the Jenkins have of who's who. We can date all the way back to slavery, to my great-grandmother, who's biracial, white and black, born into slavery. So we can go all the way back, have photos, have all of that, that leads us down to present day. Pittman's, not so. But nonetheless, just with them too as well, most of them had at least two kids. Everybody had two, and my dad had one. Now that's legally. I'm still the only child of my mom and dad. Yeah, there's some others out there. So I have a sister out there and a brother as well. And I'm saying he's in Philly. So none of this is direct from my dad. You know, it's like when people die, that's when stuff came out. And that's what happened with me when my momo, my father's mom, died. I was 15. And a woman approached me and said, hi. I said, hi. She said, you remember me? I said, no. She said, I used to hold you when you was little. No, she said, I'm your sister. I said, okay, you want to get something to eat? And she said, yes. And so we are walking, and I'm walking dead to my mom. She's right behind me, and I'm walking dead to my mom. And I said, do I got a sister? And my mom looked. Glad you're dead. So I went to my dad, and he's on the front row crying. You know, we had a funeral. He's, you know, crying. I'm like, dad, do I got a sister? And he said, yes. Yeah, you got a sister. And when I turned around, she was gone. Her name is Rennie. She was gone. And I remember that night, my parents arguing at my grandparents' house. And I can't believe you, Well, I didn't know she was going to approach him like that. She's 18. She was 18 at the time. 17, 18. And I'm 15. So she's older. Because prior to my parents getting married, there was this baby that my mom kept seeing at the house. And she would always inquire, Henry, who's this baby? Who's this baby? And the family has it as it was a cousin. Well, actually, that was what's my sister. Because if my mother knew this child was my dad, she would not have married him. But my dad kept saying that it wasn't. So she just married my dad. Because she's born in 71. She's born in 71 and I'm in 76. The reason why I know that, because later on, some documents came to the house of my father's dependents. And it was 71, 76, and 80. Hey, I know who the 76 is. Who's the 71? Who's the 80?
You are benefit only child.
So listen, grew up as the only child. I had other siblings out there. And I met Rennie.
I was going to say, do you have a relationship with her?
And no, I do not. And it's one of the things that saddens me. It saddens me because of this. Secrets and parental influence. So when I met Rennie for the first time, that was when I was 15. Then I met her again when Papa died. And just so happens it was my dad's birthday. And after the funeral, we all went out to eat afterwards. It's, you know, the whole family, aunts, cousins. And so my dad is at the head of the table, and one of his sisters, my aunt, had encouraged, how about Henry's children sit next to him? So my father's here, I'm here, Rennie's here. And I'm looking at my mother across the way, and she cutting him sharply with them eyes over there. Because it was never introduced. Martez, here's your sister, Rennie. Rennie, this is your brother, Martez. She knew of me, I didn't know of her. But there was nothing formal that was ever said. It was just, yeah, that's your sister. Okay. That's it. Mom didn't say anything about it. Dad didn't say anything else about it. So it wasn't said. And she will attempt to reach out, and yet because of the secrecy of it as a kid, even coming as an adult, well, I don't know what to do with it. I don't. It was never encouraged for me to have a relationship with her.
See, in my family, my dad was married twice. All the males on my dad's line, as you go as far back to my great-grandfather, they were all married twice. They all had two wives.
Really?
Yeah. My mom used to call it the family's curse, because then her expectation was the first marriage for my brother would never work out. You know, it was my uncle, all the dad side. So my dad had a daughter with his first wife. And we knew nothing about it until my grandfather's funeral. The first wife showed up
with the daughter, and I didn't know about it. I was like 9, maybe. And then my sister told me a few years later, she said, "Do you remember this woman?" I'm like, "No."
Right.
The next day, so she must be maybe 10 years older than me. But to this day, I'm like, secrecy. And in our family, in our culture, is very much based on shame. Shame that the marriage didn't work out. Shame that he had a child and he never kept in contact with the child. And I wonder, would it have been better if we knew about it? But that's how it affected me. But I'm curious how it affected you. And also, especially looking at from the perspective of a therapist, is there a part of you that wished that there was a relationship and what would have come out of it?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. No doubt. No doubt. Definitely. And the fact that I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist, and I am systemically trained in family dynamics and so forth. And yes, and what all would be difference in those secrets. And at the same time, as I say that, those are cornerstones of a dysfunctional family. We don't talk, we don't trust, we don't feel. We don't talk about what goes on in this. What's said in this house stays in this house. So it stays right here.
Yes.
So you don't get to explore, to ask about this or that, like those secrets. And so we don't talk. So then what do you do with these emotions that are inside? They become numb, so we don't feel. So definitely would life for that to have been different. And so even taking it upon myself to have relationships with and get information from. And sadly, as that was in the process, she ended up dying. She died the same year, a month before my dad. She died July 2017 of a heart attack. She was overweight. And then my dad died from cancer in August.
Mm. Growing up in a family with secrets, did you have to do a lot of healing, self-healing?
Yes. Yeah. Man, let me tell you. Yeah. So how I got it to feel, take you all the way back to college, to where it began. In high school, I played football and band. And I ended up getting a jazz scholarship to the local high school here. And my parents was going through a divorce at the same time because I had another scholarship opportunity outside. But I wanted to stay here with my mom. So I go to North Harris Jazz Band. That's a whole nother story there. So, but now I'm gonna go ahead and say this piece because and the instrument I play is trombone, aka slide. And I remember going down the hallway. And all I'm hearing is and I mean it's just all this music going on. I'm like, oh man, them brothers in there getting it. And I walked in, I saw one black person. All these white cats just getting down. Blew my mind. I had a oof on the what's going on this. And the black guy that was playing is Century Young. Good friend, Century Young, up front playing. And man, I love that band. Oh my God, I love my whole experience there in the jazz band. Moving forward, I originally went to school to be a computer programmer. And that's what my father said I need to do. Computers are the future. So I had got certified before I went to college, because my junior year, I ended up starting a program called ACE, and it was an advanced high school that if you knew what you wanted to do, you could take these classes. And so as I'm getting my high school diploma, I'm also getting certified, and bam, I become marketing. So then college was to extend that. Yet when I got there, I was bored. I'm a people person, just being in front of the screen. While I love playing video games, RPG, computer technology, to do this every day, that's not. So I have music. The career in music would have been being a music teacher. I don't want to teach music. I should love performing music. But they didn't have it. There was no grief for performing. And so at that time, my mom, who's a nurse, had a friend, Miss Staggs, who was opening up a chemical dependency unit at Yale Hospital in Acres Homes. Now, Acres Homes is the oldest African-American community on the north side of Houston. So I'm excited because she needs substance abuse techs. So I'll be working the weekend. And it was enough money to pay for my car note, because that's all it had. You know, I'm now, I have no bills on my home. Just enough to pay my car note. Cool. And I was excited, but just because it was Black owned in the Black community, we're going to make a difference. We're going to make a change. Yeah. There was dope on campus. There were dope deals going down, transactions. The council was having sex with female clients. Patient would relapse and not get treatment. It was such a cluster. Man, look at him. I used to go into the counselor's office every day, and I would look at his certification. I said, this is going to be mine one day. It's going to be mine one day. So instead of complaining about why don't somebody do something, why don't somebody help these people, you know what, fine, I'll do it. So the next semester, I took 30 hours. I took 15 hours at North Harris. I took 15 hours at Tomball College. Got approved by the dean. 30 hours. I did my internship that summer. And then August 25th, 1998, 8 o'clock a.m., I officially became a counselor. I am a licensed chemical dependence counselor. That's the first licensure that I have. So I specialize in treating individuals with addiction, substance use. Love it. While I was going to school, I was also in a relationship at the time as well, an abusive relationship. I did not know I was in an abusive relationship until, guess what? We're talking about family dynamics and abusive family. And they're going through this criteria and this checklist, and I'm looking and I'm seeing, and my head is turning. And I'll never forget, Patricia, I went into the bathroom and I cried. And my professor, Steve Haberman, walked in and said, Henry, you all right? And I said, no, I'm not. I said, I just realized I'm in an abusive relationship. Had no clue, because from my understanding, what I see, only the male can be abusive. My father was with that thing. Only male can be abusive. I'm a male. I'm not in no abusive relationship. Like hell, I wasn't. And the fact is that everything that I was receiving, how I was taught to be, even the hitting, being striked. You know, I'm a man. I ain't striking. But nonetheless, yeah, you're hitting. It's still a hit, and being talked to, and the emotional abuse, and the things changed when I saw her that night. That was a whole different dynamic as far as the lady that I was with at the time. And then being in the world of recovery, even though I am not in recovery. Most individuals who are licensed chemical dependency counselor, they are in recovery from drugs and alcohol. So when I came on the scene, it threw a lot of people off, because here I am. I'm a non-recovering person with the LCDC. Yes, I am. Why? This is a question that throws everything off. Nonetheless, saying all of that, I never gave assignments or homework assignments to my patient that I haven't done myself. So even though I wasn't in recovery, I'm still reading the material and it fit. It all fit. It all fits for making your own inventory of yourselves and looking at what needs to be healed from you. And this is where, even though I didn't have no addiction, man, look here. My life just jacked up. Unmanageable dysfunction. And I started teaching family classes. Like, from that actual book, Don't Talk, Don't Trust, Don't Feel. And learning all these dynamics of an unhealthy home. And I said, this is mine. So going through that, learning how to communicate, learning that there's emotions. I didn't know emotions besides just anger. And then to be able to verbalize that to my parents, that I feel hurt, I feel angry, I feel irritated, I feel frustrated, I feel annoyed, I feel scared, I feel fearful, I feel cautious. So here's this development of emotional intelligence and able to have that. And it wasn't welcome. It was not welcome when I first started using an I statement. You know, Mom, I feel irritated when you call my name out yelling instead of just coming to me. What I would like is, if you need something, just come into the room and ask me instead of yelling. Oh, you irritated, huh, Mr. Pittman? That's what I know I'm in trouble. Mr. Pittman, my mom calls me Mr. Pittman. Oh, so you feel irritated, huh, Mr. Pittman? Yes. And so is learning what is and peeling, I don't want to say peeling back the curtains. It's me humbling and doing my own self-examination of this as well. Just because I am a professional, I have no issues. No. I think that's a big issue too with people at the master's levels who become therapists. You know, well, I'm a therapist. That don't mean jack. It means that you can pass an exam. Congratulations. You still got work to do. You still got your own self-examination. And so that was one of the things that led me to continue my education to get my master level license. Because at the time, that was just an associate's to be a licensed chemical dependency counselor. And so when I started seeing other stuff that was beyond my scope of practice, I can't even name it, Patricia, but I'm like, I don't know what that is. That's not drug and alcohol. And there was a gentleman named Lucky Kurt. And he was a probation officer at the time. And I was working at New Directions Club Incorporated. So it's a halfway house dealing with offenders. And I'm a TC counselor, which stands for a therapeutic community. So we're very confrontational on patients' behavior. So in the TC community, you're learning about being my brother's keeper. If I see that your bed is not made, I'm going to be my brother's keeper and I'm going to bring it to your attention, man. Your bed is not made. You'll get in trouble for that. So it's holding people accountable for behavior so they can unlearn about snitching or that don't concern me. You just look the other way. It's about holding people accountable as behaviors. And if one person get in trouble, everybody get in trouble. That's the TC model. And we're confronting behaviors, but it's strategically done. You're not, and people get the wrong idea when you're talking about confrontation, is that you're yelling, screaming, that's hostility. No, confrontation is just bringing with face, bringing to the table what something is. That is confrontation. That's all that is. Hey, I lend you $20 and you still have not paid me back. That's a confrontation. I'm bringing that on the table. And I'm not pleased that I have to ask you for the $20 that you was going to give me. I am confronting an issue. I'm just bringing it here. Not say, man, you know, you hold me to. No, I'm being hostile. That's with my confrontation. That's different.
Oh, please give us another example of this, because I love this, because we have such a misunderstanding of confrontation.
Oh, yes.
Right? What's another example that you come across that you think, oh, we are so misunderstood with the term confrontation?
There's so many stuff that's going through my mind right now, Patricia. What's going through my mind is, one, I'm thinking about patience. Then I'm also thinking about real world, real time.
Well,
and so, not just patience, but also in real time, confrontation. Here's the confrontation. Routinely, I get my daughter, and me and her mom, not together. I get my daughter, and this is when she was younger. I would get her, bring her here. She would take her bag, put it in her room. Then she would say, "Daddy, can I watch Cartoon Network in the living room?" "Yes, sweetie, you can." And then she goes and turns on the TV. This particular weekend, the day before, I had cleaned out my closet, not putting clothes I couldn't wear, and I put them in trash bags. And her room was right next to my room. It's an L, but right next to mine. So I take the bags of clothes and I put them in her room just temporarily so I can get them and then transfer them. And yet when I went to pick her up, I did not remove them. So my daughter comes in and she goes to the room. And I said, "Sweetie, you can go ahead and watch Cartoon Network." She's like, no, Dad, I'm going to put my stuff up. I said, I get it. You can just go ahead and watch Cartoon. No, Dad, I got it. She's doing whatever that she's been taught. So she goes and she puts her stuff up. And I'm in the kitchen. And my daughter says, "Dad," I said, "Yes, sweetie. Is my room the garbage room?" I said, "No, sweetie." She said, "Then how come there's garbage bags in my room, Dad?" I said, "The garbage bags are my clothes that I took out of my room." And she said, "Okay, so how come they're in my room?" I said, "Because I did not take them out before you came, sweetie." And she said, "Are you going to take them out?" I said, "Yes, sweetie, I am." She said, "Okay, can I watch TV?" "Yes." Bringing to face, the root word of confrontation, con, C-O-N, with face. You're bringing it here. It's a confrontation. And so she's bringing simply my attention. "Dad, is my room the garbage room?" "No." "Then how come there are garbage bags in my room?" All valid. I've shared that with other adults. And the first thing come out of their mouth is, "She is disrespectful. She going to talk to the adult?" Oh. Who says she's disrespectful? Disrespectful. Respect is showing positive due regard. She asked a question in the same tone of voice. There was no high pitch or low pitch. There was no sassiness. It was none of that. She just asked a question. And positive due regard. It was very respectful. So who said it's disrespectful? But we'll label some of that as, well, disrespectful for a kid to question an adult. That's what it was. Oh, question. So about, you mean a kid cannot hold an adult accountable? Because it is a question. It was a question that inquired. And therefore, depending on if I chose to be honest or not, for me to be honest, it's for me to be accountable for my behavior, which I was. There's no issue there. But if there's adults who didn't want to own and they was going to be shamed for themselves, oh, they would have lashed at the kid. "What you think you're doing talking to me? This is my, until you pay bills in this house, you can't ask no questions. Get out of my face, girl, and go and watch the TV." That's how parents would have behaved.
With your work in chemical dependency, and you've been doing this field for so long, and abuse, we always hear the term, "You don't know until you know."
You got that right. You got that right.
With your experience, you know how we always hear people say that people are stuck in abusive relationship, whether it's physical or sexual or verbal, and maybe even narcissistic relationship. And a lot of people would judge and say, well, they should just leave the partner. But it's not that easy, because when you don't see it, you just don't see it. With your experience, are there any things that you think that can help people recognize that, oh, they are in a toxic relationship? Or do you think that we must all each come to it on our own, those who are affected?
It actually, from my experience, it is actually both. You don't know until you know. You literally don't know until you know. One thing about being licensed mental health professionals is educating patients when they come in of symptoms, and just talking about in relationships, those type of dynamics was present. Because I actually had a patient, and that was what was coming up. We can't work on her PTSD because she kept bringing up these relationship dynamics, and red flag was going on. Same thing with another couple. The husband drinking.
Well,
kind of favors that of an alcohol substance use disorder, as evidenced by .. and I present the symptoms. And that's initially what one can only do. I can only give patient information, because the other element is denial. Denial is the cloak of deception. It stops us from making an honest inventory of ourselves. So if I bring you some information, do you choose to take it in or choose to keep it out here? And rightfully so, because denial does have its place. It blocks psychological trauma. It's a healthy defense mechanism until it's not. When you hear that somebody has died, hey, such as died, the first thing is,
What?
When? And then it begins to sink in as, okay, so when's the funeral? Being in abusive relationships, being in toxic relationships, and giving the signs and symptoms of it, and then for them to take it in. And it's just the more to take in, because you really have to understand this here. All of us live in our own world. And what I know is what I know. And now you bring me some information that begins to, it influences what it is that I thought is, that it is not. And really have to understand what the realization of that impact does to a person's mindset, to an ego.
Yeah,
I mean, the classic movie is The Matrix. I mean, can you raise it? So, you think that's air that you're breathing? Morpheus, I can't see that because you never used your eyes. You know, it's so to let that information come in and cultivate, and then allowing the person to then see for themselves, and even for ourselves, oh, this is what's going on. And what does that mean to me once I realize this is what's going on in my family, that I'm actually in a toxic relationship? I am in an abusive relationship. I never thought I'd be in an abusive relationship. Not me. I'm not the type of person that allowed this to happen. There's so many ideology that becomes conflicting and cross when new information arises, and for me to see it for what it is. And then once I see it from what it is, now what do I do? Some individuals are in constraint relationships where there's something that locks us together where we can't move out that easily. Mm-hmm. It could be financial, could be kids, could be financial agreements, locations. There's other, these factors that comes in. It's just not this simple boop. And you can't pull nobody out. You can't force nobody out. It ain't going to happen. Understanding all of that I said is being there and being supportive to them, that when it does click or when the individual is ready, I gotcha, which I always will be ready. I'm just not going to cross that line to come save you, because I can't save you. But I'm here whenever you're ready. All you got to do is cross the line and I'm right here. Yeah.
In your years of being in this field, have you had to unlearn anything? Or did you have preconceived ideas about being a therapist that now when you look back after all these years, you think, what I learned are not conducive to working with clients?
I said no, because I haven't changed nothing except competency. But it started off with me in college. So I went to San Francisco State University. I did the dual program for licensed magic field therapist and professional counselor. That's why I have dual licensure. Well, I have four licensures, but that program was with those two. And so understanding counseling theories and approaches, and the reason why one individual have a therapeutic approach where one is in the upper level and where one is not. As far as, you know, the classic psychoanalysis, that you have a therapeutic facade. You are seen as the expert. That is the purpose of that approach. It's not face-to-face. The person is lying down on the couch and the therapist is behind them. Because I'm playing this piece as one's ego. And we're doing the free association. There's a reasoning for that in a particular therapeutic structure. So for me, coming in, is that social butterfly, psychoanalysis was not my thing. I understood it, got it. But for me, I didn't have the therapeutic facade. I can do the therapeutic facade. You know, a patient say something, I'm like, ooh. And my professor say, Henry, you don't want to. My goal was to do therapy without doing therapy. I wanted therapy to be like us kicking in the living room. Mm-hmm. It didn't have to be so formal. And why say, ooh, I can still give a therapeutic response and reflect of it, not saying, ooh, just to say, ooh, ooh. I can imagine that was devastating for you. I'm using a reflective statement. Instead of just saying, ooh, what happened next? Because that's being caught up in the story. I'm not being therapeutically present in it. You can still do the same. You can still be present and do what it is that one do in a regular conversation style, still being therapeutically minded, which means I got to be clinically minded in it. And in the background, I still keep therapeutic boundaries with me, with all patients that I have, because I'm a clinician. So you don't cross boundaries. Mm-hmm. I don't have my kids or my family members' pictures up in my wall, in my office, and so forth. That is not going to assist your symptomology that you present to me. I've had a couple say, Mr. Pittman, you ain't saying anything about your relationships with us. Correct. I haven't. I am a clinician to help you with yours, because by you knowing my family dynamic, how does that help me? How does that help you with the infidelity that you're having with your wives? Once again, that ain't being mean. Nothing. How is that beneficial to what you're bringing in? It doesn't. So are you looking for a clinician? Or are you looking for a mentor? Because they're not the same. And there's different pieces of that. You have people say, well, you're not married or you don't have kids. That's a mentorship you're looking for. Because other than that, you're carrying the notion that only a female doctor who has kids can actually assist with the birthing process. So only a doctor with schizophrenia can treat patients with schizophrenia. So only a doctor who has cancer can treat patients who have cancer. Is this that type of ideology with it? You know, only a recovering alcoholic can treat another alcoholic. No, a clinician can. I'm here to treat symptomologies of it. And so being in the years, been able to cultivate a rapport where I can connect to patients, we can relate to patients at the same time as clinically done. Because when those boundaries cross, there's hardship that takes place. Because I have learned that by boundaries being softened, so to speak, and come back and bite me in the behind. Most of that with my own people. I really don't have conflicts with others. It's my own people. You need have another channel for that. Boy, let me tell you. So, but still this piece for me is of clinical competency. Because that's just something that individuals have approached me about. Why don't you use this here because the white man this? Gotcha. I do. It's clinically competent for me. Mm-hmm. I get clinical results. So people say, you're a black therapist? No, I am a therapist who is black. I don't treat blackness. I'm a therapist who's black. Oh, that irks me so much. So, you know, I see black women for this, and I see black men for this here. Henry, who do you see? I see everybody.
Mm-hmm.
I have African-American, I have Caucasian, I have French, I have Indian, I got Vietnamese, I have Mexican, Hispanic, I have Persians, I have Iranians. I have the whole spectrum. I have a practice that treats individuals who wants to heal. That's it.
How did you end up with some in somatic experiencing?
Gina Gomez. So I got trained in EMDR, and Gina Gomez did a plug for SE. She said, hi, my name is Gina Gomez. Welcome to trauma training here that I just want to give you a plug about type of training approach to treating trauma. How many here are training EMDR? And a lot of people raised their hand. And how many here are training SE, somatic experiencing? It was two people, her. And the other person was with her. And she, like somatic experience, only two of y'all are here. Wow. Well, I invite you to learn more about somatic experience, about how to heal trauma from the body. I said, what from the body? Had me curious. Two reasons. One, my background is one of, I'm a Tai Chi practitioner. I used to teach Tai Chi at the local college. So, understand energy, chi. That's my background.
Mm-hmm.
My school of thought is Choice Theory Reality Therapy by William Glassner. It's a comprehensive cognitive behavior therapy treatment where we focus on behavior. You can't lie with behavior. Behavior is what it is. If a person talk about losing weight, why are you here in the buffet? You talking about losing weight? Why are you here in the buffet? That means you ain't talking about losing weight because you're here in the buffet. Behavior don't lie. It is what it is. And so then we do a backtrack as far as we focus on behavior. From the back door, we begin to identify cognitions versus traditional cognitive behavior therapy. We identify the cognition and what is the error in logic that sits in it. Because if you change the thought, change the behavior. Choice theory, reality therapy is behavior oriented. We focus on your behavior, then backtrack. And so the analogy for choice theory reality therapy is a car, is that the front wheels is behavior, thought. Thoughts is connected to the rear wheel, which is emotions, and behavior is connected to the back wheel, which is physiology. A person is always holistically present at all times. They're here. So when I learn about SE, SE connects with the physiology of choice theory reality therapy. Of course, not to that depth that SE does, but nonetheless, it talks about physiology. An individual physical is present in the moment. When we talk about a person being depressed, well, they're depressing, it's ing, they're depressing in the moment. That's what they're doing. They're depressing. It's this dude. And so, went to the introduction of SE, and that's it. I'm up. I'm in. Let's do this here.
In another reality, what would you be doing?
Well, I'll be a chef. I'll be a chef. But the fact is that this is me. Being a therapist, no matter what I do, or another way for me to answer it, my personality, because I actually did take personality assessment. I'm a public servant. So no matter what it is that I will be doing, I will still be in the public. Because I'm a previous commissioned officer. So security, right. It's public. Teacher at the local college, public. No matter what it is that I would do, I'm always going to be a public servant. Therefore, assisting and volunteering comes easy with me. That's the reason why I take it seriously on many levels as far as assisting, making sure that they learn accurately, learn right. I cannot stand it when teaching is done incompetently. I cannot stand it.
I wish the viewers can see your face.
Yeah, and it's especially when it comes more of people of color. One of my favorite movies, and this I have to explain, is Glory. It was a movie that came out in the 80s with Denzel Washington, Morgan Freeman, Matthew Broderick. He was playing the character Colonel Shaw, and it was about the Civil War. And it was about the all-black regiment. I said, there's a particular scene in it where they get rifles, and they finally get rifles, and they're shooting. And they're betting each other as far as how this one particular guy, how good he is. He can shoot. Well, here comes Colonel Shaw. He's coming. Attention. And everybody's coming. And Colonel Shaw, very handy with the rifle. And the guy stutters because he's that good of a shot from hunting squirrels. He said, if you would, do it again. And he loads and he shoots. He said, good. He said, reload. He's okay. Like, faster. Faster. Sergeant, give me your Colt 45. Takes the gun. Faster. And he gets the gun bound. Faster. Now let's shoot. Reload. Faster. 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 And the guy's just shaking his. And he said, a well-trained army man can shoot, and I cannot remember, 3 to 5 shots in a minute. Be able to reload and shoot that minute. You're talking about put the powder in, stuff it, pack it, and shoot with accuracy. And the colonel says, Sergeant, teach these men properly. He's like, yes, sir. Many times, the fact that people of color are not taught accurately what it is, the level, this is what it is, versus, well, this is what they did. No. Let me teach you how to accurately do this here. Let me teach you how to accurately be competent. That's what it is. So no matter what I will be doing, that level of competency of period, it's always will be there in all of that. That's why you see me at the trainings when I talk about hand position. I want you to really understand where your hand position goes and how come it goes here. Even though I get the understanding, we're just going to mock around. Don't want to mock around too much because you can go into a person's thoracic viscera and activate and you won't even know it. Therefore, let's stick to the diaphragm area here around the rib cage, 3-4 ups, the kid, and just hold. Notice what's happening in your body. Really want you to learn it. That's how they learn it. I know because I'm in the same damn classes with them and I learned it on that level. I just learned SE, period. Period.
Would you ever become like a professor with your belief in that, the competency? Would you like, because I think then you could take that into teaching.
Yes. Yes. And the answer to that question is yes. So even now, I'm already on the pre-faculty track for SE.
Last question, Kate. Any advice for new therapists?
Yes. Where do I start? One of them is this here. One advice is this here. Do not throw away your grad school books. The reason being, when you went to grad school, you read those chapters to pass an exam. That's what you read it for. You didn't read it for the knowledge itself to incorporate it. You read it to pass the exam. No harm, no foul. It is what it is. Now, since you're out of school, read that material for what it is. And it's so much of a wealth of knowledge that was not taught in the classroom. It's in the books. When I assist in SE and people say, oh man, I didn't know, I didn't learn that. What did you learn that at? I said, it's in the manual. Mm-hmm. Oh, it is? You didn't read it. I see you didn't read the manual. Not only the professors in SEC will tell you, we don't teach from the manual. They don't. But this, that doesn't mean you don't read it. They're just not going to teach it because they want to focus on this. And there's so much in grad school that people, that students miss, to where when they come into the field, coming into the field, they are so underdeveloped as practitioners. It's not even funny. And at the same time, many don't know until you bring it to their attention. If you have a supervisor that knows as well, which is this other piece, the other piece about advice is, even though you have gotten your hours and you got your license, it's still for you to have a clinical mentor.
Mm-hmm.
Your clinical supervisor is responsible for your clinical development as a clinician. Many times you just got somebody who signed off on your hours. Pretty much is what they did. Any problem this week? Anything you want to talk about? Okay, done. Sign off. That's what you got. You never learn how to be a clinician. Truly understanding what are these 12 core functions of counseling, from screening, intake, assessment, counseling, client education, crisis intervention, case management, consultation, report and record keeping, discharging, how to do that clinically, how to verbalize the diagnosis. And even when we talk about having a therapeutic dialogue with someone, how to conduct active listening and probing and empathizing, negotiating, challenging. There's these elements of how to become just naturally therapeutic. That's part of the development. That was your supervisor's responsibility. Many failed that. So just because, yes, I got my license, but then also seek clinical mentorship as far as cultivating and developing my clinical skills, and it don't stop. It doesn't stop no matter what. And probably one of the most urgent thing is learning a school of thought and mastering it. Many individual practitioners, they take multiple trainings and don't master nothing. Don't master nothing. How do you expect to really be competent and actually help people heal if you're not, you have not mastered a school of thought? If you're doing CBT, cool, master it first. Before you end up learning CBT, and there's many types of CBTs. But if you're doing EMDR, I said, master it. Get your certification, master it. If you're learning IFS, master it first before you start going off and I want to do SE. Because there's so much in each one. If you notice that the individuals who create these approaches, that's all they do. You know, Peter Levine does SE. Sue Johnson does emotion-focused therapy. Dick Schwartz does IFS. William Glassner does CTRT. Ain't none of them taking in and doing this and that. They came across something they liked. They found it, and they put their energy into it and mastered it and becomes effective. So you don't have to, how to say that? You do not have to take all these trainings to be able to do everything. I don't think it was never designed for us to be therapists to do everything. I think part of that comes with greed. You want to be an in-house shop. Well, I do a little this, a little this, mm-hmm. a little that. Versus if you're a heart surgeon, I do heart surgery. That's all I do. I don't do anything else with the body. So people come to see me because that's what I do. I'm a brain surgeon or ENT. And of course, you can have your general practitioners, not knocking them, which would pretty much be trained in supportive psychotherapy. Yet you're competent in it. And if individuals need more work done that is outside of your scope of practice and expertise at the supportive level, then yes, you end up referring. Because other than that, supportive therapy is very effective in what it is that it does. So I know you just asked me one question. I gave you a lot of stuff. with it. But those are the things that is heavy on my heart as far as advice, new practitioner. Reread your book. Clinical mentorship, master a school of thought before you end up taking multiple trainings.
I love your advice, especially rereading your books because oftentimes when you're doing your master's, it's just survival.
It's
just survival.
And I totally agree with your advice of mastering one thing, because so many people think, oh, it looks good on my resume. I'm going to do all these trainings. I also tell new therapists, don't take the training until you have personally experienced it, because then you don't understand what the client is going through. For example, with somatic experiencing, if you've never done it, you don't know. You don't know how it feels to be on the other chair as a client.
I'm also an AccuDetox specialist, so I do AccuDetox. And it came out of me being a licensed chemical dependency counselor that there is a license approved just for ocular acupuncture for chemical dependency therapists, counselors, because it helps with cravings and urges. It's phenomenal. Yeah, it helps with cravings and urges. And so the first day of class, we talk about doing it yourself. First day of class, we all lined up. All right, so you would take the needle kit out, all right? And if you would, grab one needle with your right hand, okay? And turn to your left, and you will see your neighbor's ear. This is first day of class. Take the needle, and there's a ridge that's in the middle of the ear, ridge, and won't you put the needle in that location? We're looking at, are you saying? So one person, and everybody, ow. And they said, okay, now you have felt what it is, how not to do it. Now I want your patient to experience what you just experienced.
Well, you guys are kind of cool. No, I don't know whether you know this. So I was a licensed acupuncturist for 14 years. That's what I did before I became a therapist. Yes.
Hey.
And you just look like cool. When we first started in school, it was like, please bring an orange with you.
Okay.
So it was practiced in the orange first, so you can feel how it feels to go into the skin.
That is cool.
Because they say, technically, they say, if you insert a needle into an orange, it's as close to how it will feel on the flesh, on the skin. So you guys are more hardcore than me. Just go.
Yeah, just.
But, oh my God. I have a request before we end this. Mm-hmm. When you were sharing that you went to the band practice and you saw them practicing, and then you did
the sounds.
Will you do that to finish out the episode? You're so good at it.
Oh, thank you. Yes.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
That was so fun. What a great conversation with Henry. This week's advice from EE, me, your Chinese auntie, is to trust that you are more than enough. Especially when it comes to learning a new skill for your job. Whether you're a therapist or an artist or creative, learn a skill well, experience it, then take additional training if you want to. Remember, you don't need to learn everything. The Western capitalistic viewpoint tells us that we need to keep learning, to keep taking courses to be quote-unquote better. This brings me to the topic of when you are looking at someone's offerings, whether it is for a body worker, practitioner, or therapist, consider what you think are essential. are they based on what the Western ideology has taught you? Do more credentials mean they are more skillful? Pay attention to your expectations when you meet someone. Consider this. Oftentimes when we look at someone, we think, oh, the more education, the more credentials they have, that means they're more skillful. It's not necessarily true. A young chef in Japan begins their apprenticeship at the end of high school, and they will complete the apprenticeship in 10 years. This is what traditionally, how long it takes to become a sushi chef in Japan, because they keep practicing the skill. I know this doesn't apply to everyone, and we live in a Western world where oftentimes jobs tell us that we need to take more training, or we look at social media and there's so many offerings. But reconsider, why are you taking extra training? Is it because you think that it will make you better and more marketable? That is something to consider. I hope you have a great week. Much love to you.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Conversations with Your Chinese Auntie podcast. If you're enjoying the show, please feel free to rate, subscribe, and leave a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. That helps others find the show, and we greatly appreciate it. Also, remember to sign up for our newsletter to receive free materials and updates. Links in the website, patriciapeterson.ca. That's PATRICIAPETERSEN.ca. Again, thanks for listening. We hope you have a great week, and we'll see you in the next episode.